Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Bernie Sanders wins in New Hampshire with moderates hard on his heels. But can his populism beat Donald Trump's? We'll speak to Congressman Ro Khanna, co-chair of the Sanders campaign. Then, why the global climate change movement could reshape finance. We talk to BlackRock's Brian Deese as the loudest voice on Wall Street takes a stand on coal. Plus, as the battle to contain the coronavirus intensifies, we look at another of its side effects, racism. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. With the Democratic primaries in full swing and the election in November, one of the major issues is climate change, certainly among young voters wherever they are in the world. And public pressure is also mounting on Wall Street. BlackRock, the world's largest fund manager, has probably the loudest voice at that table as it manages assets worth $7 trillion, including many pension funds. But now the company says it'll put sustainability at the heart of its investment decisions, divest from coal. Brian Deese is global head of the sustainable investment at BlackRock. He previously served as a senior advisor to President Obama, and he played an important role in negotiating the Paris Climate Agreement. He's joining me now to discuss this from New York. Brian Deese, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So would you say, just as a starting gambit, that BlackRock is also susceptible and sensitive to what people want, what the public is now saying?
Well, from our perspective, we think about all these issues in the context of what will affect long-term return and what will generate the best long-term financial outcomes for our clients. And so one of the things that we have thought a lot about and heard a lot about on these broad issues of sustainability, but particularly climate change, is that the changing expectations of society, of the young people around the world, the global movements that are raising the pressure on this set of issues is actually having a feedback effect into how companies operate. And so that is something that we pay very close attention to, because increasingly, whether a company can maintain its license to operate in the communities that it serves or with the customers that it serves is going to be a part of whether it can sustain profitability over the long term. So in that sense, we are very focused on these questions of where is public sentiment, but to the degree that it will actually affect how long-term value is created.
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit more a little later about public value and profitability. But first, let's talk about what you are talking about and what your CEO, Larry Fink, has announced, that BlackRock will no longer actively invest in companies that generate more than 25% of their profits from coal production. That's what he said in a letter. So just flesh that out a little bit before we get to the nitty-gritty. Why just 25%, for instance?
Sure. So I think the place that we start is with the basic view that climate risk is investment risk. And that has not been the view in financial markets traditionally. But increasingly, we have conviction that that is going to be the case going forward. So increasingly, whether it's the physical impacts of climate change, you think about the increased incidence of wildfires, whether that's in California or Australia, but also the risks that are posed by new technologies and new regulations that are forcing carbon-intensive industries to change and adapt. These risks are real, and they're putting pressure on companies and their business models. So as we look at that question of climate risk, we look at those industries and those areas that are the most likely to be affected. Now, we've taken a specific position on thermal coal, and as you say, 25% or more of revenue in derived from thermal coal mining, that's a subsegment where we think that the investment risks are large enough that in our active portfolios where we have discretion, it's not worth holding. But the issue of risk actually extends far beyond that to companies in the value chain of energy production, in transportation, in logistics, mm-hmm. and supply chains around the world. So our focus is much broader than the coal issue, but we have made a specific decision in that segment.
Okay, so let's just take that decision and that segment. You just mentioned active investment. 11% of BlackRock's fund money is in active funds, and 89% goes into passive investment. So passive investment, people who play this game know that it means putting money into something, leaving it there, often into funds or an index tracker. But by making a distinction between active and passive, what you're basically saying is that, you'll do this sustainability for what, 10%-ish of what you manage. But what about the other 90%-ish? I mean, it's a big amount that will still go into companies that hold, other kinds of coal and fossil fuels.
Yeah. So we start from this premise that we view this as risk and investment risk. And then we think about how do we apply that to our business. So you're right. We start in the portfolios where we have discretion, about $1.8 trillion in portfolios that we manage where we have discretion, these so-called active portfolios. And there we can express our sustainability views by making decisions about where to sell in or out of a particular security. In the portfolios that we manage, where we manage against an index, the question is, how do we express our views about sustainability? And we can't simply, if a client says they want us to deliver the S&P 500, we legally deliver them the S&P 500. But we don't stop there. We have said that our views around sustainability are going to cause us to do two things. One, we want to offer as many choices as possible. So we have committed to creating sustainable versions of all of the major flagship indices that we offer so that if a client wants to invest with a sustainable orientation, they have the ability to do that.
Okay, so...
And the second is where we do own a stake in those companies, we'll engage directly with them on behalf of our clients to reinforce the importance of these sustainability-related issues to long-term returns.
Okay, so just not to be, too much of a, cold water agent here. According to Influence Map, which is, as you know, the UK-based nonprofit think tank, BlackRock was investing about 150 million tons of coal through its active funds, as we've discussed, still investing in 1.2 billion tons of coal through its passive funds. So, this is a huge, huge, huge difference of what's still investing. And because you've portrayed it in terms of, responsibility and profit and, to your shareholders and all the rest of it, I just want to ask you to react to what Andrew Ross Sorkin, the business correspondent, has written in the New York Times just last month. He basically said, had Mr. Fink moved a decade ago to pull BlackRock funds out of companies that contribute to climate change, his clients would have been well served. In the past 10 years through Friday, companies in the S&P 500 energy sector had gained just 2% in total, while in the same period, the broader S&P 500 nearly tripled. In other words, fossil fuels are a losing ticket. So all that you're saying now and portraying it in basically the financial imperative is still not enough, right? And you should have been doing it a lot earlier, but you're still investing a lot in this sector.
Look, I would say a couple of things to that. The first is that in the passive business that we manage, we are taking a set of quite significant steps to to lead the industry, including just this week announcing that we will offer a new series of index funds, ETFs, that allow investors to allocate their capital into a index tracking strategies where there is where we're eliminating exposure to fossil fuel companies broadly. We want to make those options available. And this, the second point is that we are trying to increasingly communicate our view that these climate risks are increasingly salient as investment risks, and that financial markets broadly are not fully prepared for the magnitude of the capital reallocation to come. And so we can look backward and we can look forward, but what we're communicating today is that we believe that these climate-related issues, whether it's facing traditional energy companies or real estate or consumer goods companies, are going to play an increasing role in valuation going forward. And we want to be ahead of that on behalf of our clients, but we also want to communicate that view more broadly to financial markets. Mm-hmm.
So I guess another question, because, again, you know, we're all mindful of the culture, the politics, the needle that is seriously shifting and did, you know, all through 2019, thanks to, in part, in great part, Greta Thunberg, the youth movement, elections, which showed that, you know, climate was massively a big priority over many, many other issues for people all over the world. So it's great that you're doing your bit, but as we've just discussed, it's only a fraction of what you could be doing. And particularly, you are only talking about coal, and you're not talking about divesting in any form or fashion from oil or gas. You know, the Guardian report today says the big producers, BP, Shell, Chevron, Exxon, have made also almost $2 trillion in profits in the past three decades as their exploitation of oil, gas, and coal reserves continue. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I would say that what we're witnessing and what we're going to witness is a significant transition, and the transition to decarbonize our economy, not just in the energy sector, but again, across different sectors of our economy. It is important that that will be a transition. It will operate over years and in some cases decades. Now, what our view is that that transition is going to happen more quickly than a number of financial market participants expect. But I would challenge the idea that all we are doing is connected to the places where we're actively divesting. Because the most important thing to identify is not necessarily are you going to divest from entire sectors or segments, but instead, where are those companies and where are those business models that are the most prepared for this transition? And so we spend a lot of time asking the question, not necessarily are you going to exit the entire oil and gas industry or all utilities globally, but instead, within those sectors, which are the companies that are the most prepared, that are investing the most in the clean technologies of the future, and which of those companies are less prepared? Because as investors, if we're identifying those companies, we want to be on the front end of this transition. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's important that we not allow this conversation to go into too narrow a debate between divest or not divest. We see this in the policy arena as well. This is going to be a global transition. And I think that what we're trying to do is to get ahead of that transition on behalf of our clients across sectors and across different aspects of the economy.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about specific companies and, you know, what you can do and in this sector. So let's take a specific company and a specific mine, the Adani mine and the Siemens company. In Australia, as you know, one of the biggest coal mines is in the process right now of being built. And scientists have said, environmentalists, very, very highly respected ones, that this is going to, you know, destroy what's left of the Great Barrier Reef. And let's not forget that we're in the middle of these massive fires. And the engineering company Siemens has signed this lucrative deal to build parts of the train and the rail system there. And you, BlackRock, are a majority shareholder in Siemens. So this is what the CEO of Greenpeace has said just this month. Australia's coal-fired bushfires are still raging. Koalas are burning alive. Fires threaten families all over the country. And our capital city is choking on toxic smoke. And yet companies like BlackRock and Siemens continue to support fossil fuels by aiding projects like Adani's Carmichael coal mine. Now, yes, you did criticize them over, you know, their role in this project, Siemens. But then you backed all the management decisions and resolutions which were put forth at Siemens' annual meeting, the BlackRock-backed Siemens. So, again, you know, What's the bottom line here? Where do you really use your influence as this massive voice, this massive, you know, shareholder and this ability to really talk to companies at these annual meetings?
Yeah, so a couple things. So first, we're not a majority shareholder. We own a stake in that company through the investments in passive index funds. Second, as you pointed out, we, as we committed to earlier this year, we have been more transparent and clear about our engagement with that company and specifically our concerns about how that company has handled the decisions around its engagement with the Carmichael mine. And we were quite public about that in ways that I would argue you are not seeing necessarily other asset managers do. But to your question about where we can make a difference, we can do that in three ways. One is where we have discretion in our active portfolios, we can make active decisions on behalf of our clients. Where we're managing passive funds, we can work to democratize access, and we're doing more than any other company in the space to create investment options, low-cost investment options for investors to choose. And we can communicate our investment view that for those clients that we have, we can sit with them and explain to them why we believe that taking a sustainability first approach in their investments is the right way to think about long-term return. Our clients are large pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, all around the world whose end beneficiaries are often long-term savers saving for retirement or education or otherwise. And we have a role to play in educating them about the decisions that they're making. Ultimately, that end decision goes to the asset owner, but we can and we are now stepping into playing a role in communicating our views and helping to educate them on what we believe will be the best for their long-term outcome.
Okay, so that sounds really great. I mean, your own CEO, Larry Fink, has put it, the money that BlackRock manages is not its own. I mean, it is the people's money, right? And according, again, to this influence map, BlackRock appear absent from this shift in company engagement on climate from the asset management sector. So again, I know you're saying that you want to, you know, influence and guide and direct some of these companies and use your big voice at the shareholder meetings and at that table. Is it going to take a bit more then to get these companies over the line?
Well, again, what we've said, I would challenge that an editorial statement that we've been absent. BlackRock engages directly with more companies more frequently than any other asset manager in the world. And beyond that, we committed earlier this year to two things. One, we're going to be more transparent about how we engage and what we engage on, so that when our clients or the public have questions, we're clear. And I think you see that in the example of Siemens that you raised. And secondly, we said that increasingly on issues of climate-related disclosure and understanding companies' plans to adapt to low-carbon transitions across time, we have less patience with companies now that there has been a couple of years for companies to get used to, for example, how to report on climate-related issues in the wake of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure that came out a few years ago. And so as we look at company progress, we are going to be increasingly disposed to vote against management where we don't see that progress and where we don't see that action. So I think you'll see from us both increased transparency and increased urgency around this set of issues. Again, consistent with our view that the investment salience of this issue is increasing in the market.
So it's really important, obviously, because BlackRock, as we've said, I mean, is such a massive company, has so many trillions, and could be a game changer. So it's really important that you've taken this stance, and you know, we'll obviously be very interested to watch how it proceeds. But I want to ask you also about, you know, your personal journey to an extent. I mean, you, as we said in the introduction, worked under both terms of President Obama, senior advisor, you were very important in the negotiating team for the Paris Climate Accord. I just wonder how, you know, your personal experience shapes your current job at this major corporation. Let me just ask you that, because in view of the current administration's sort of disdain for the climate crisis.
Well, one of the perspectives that I bring, having worked on this set of issues from the policy side, is that ultimately the solution to accelerating this transition to a low-carbon economy and to solving the climate crisis is going to take the partnership and the intersection between public policy and private markets. And ultimately, to really see an acceleration in that transition, we're going to need both. You need strong, consistent public policy signals that allow investors to invest in low carbon solutions and in low carbon systems. But you also need financial markets to evolve and to up their game and recognize that assuming a world that is climatically stable is no longer an acceptable way to invest in the future. And so we're going to need these two things to come together. And certainly that's a personal journey that I've been on both sides of this, but also something that I have increasing conviction about. And so I think that from the vantage point I have now, from the BlackRock perspective, we're also trying to be clear that having clearer and better global public policy on this, including in this very critical year of 2020, where countries are intended to step forward and re-up their commitments under the Paris Agreement, having this intersection between finance and global public policy and figuring out ways to have that work more seamlessly together is going to be a critical piece of this puzzle. Mm.
And I just, again, want to, from a personal and maybe even from a business perspective, want to ask your views on the young people who have shifted the dial. Greta Thunberg, for instance, you know, she takes massive risks and she's devoted a huge amount of her own time and effort and sacrifice, inspiring hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people all over the world. And yet the most important and powerful people in the world troll her, insult her, whether it's the president, whether it's Steve Mnuchin, the secretary of the Treasury, who recently said, who is she, the chief economist, whether it's the chief foreign policy official of the European Union. Just, you know, people need something to be able to believe in and to get behind. And grassroots is really important in our cultures and our civilizations. How do you just react and assess this grassroots movement?
Look, I think that we've seen across history that society helps to move big institutions, whether they be in politics or in business or otherwise. And I think we're seeing that happen in real time. You know, I was part of the process that led to the Paris Agreement and the grassroots movement that happened over the course of 2015 and escalated to bring us all there at the end of 2015 was absolutely critical to encouraging, nudging, prodding, shaming the countries of the world to actually come together. I will tell you that having lived through that in 2015, I think 2019 will go down as an even more consequential year because this organic grassroots outpouring of support, I think largely driven by the extraordinarily stark findings of the IPCC report and the impacts on our world and on in particular, the least resourced communities and countries around the world if we don't keep global average temperatures from increasing, has sparked a global movement. I think it's there's extraordinary power to that, and that we all, whether we are citizens or policymakers or investors, need to take that very seriously. We need to engage with it, and we need to understand that that sentiment is not going away. It reflects a larger underlying frustration with institutions of power not solving this problem, and it reflects a commitment that that people around the world, individual humans, will band together and will vote with their feet, mm-hmm. will vote with their at the ballot box, and with their dollars as well.
Yeah, it's really important. Great to hear from you. Brian Deese, head of sustainable investment at BlackRock. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It is now two down and no closer to winnowing the race for the Democratic nomination. With progressive Bernie Sanders' squeaker of a victory in New Hampshire and the moderate Pete Buttigieg nipping at his heels, what does this ideological divide mean for the party's direction and its ability to beat President Trump in November? Especially since the presumed Trump slayer, Joe Biden, came in fifth place with no delegates at all out of New Hampshire. And as the focus shifts now to more diverse states, Nevada and South Carolina, Sanders' new front-runner status has left some Democratic Party grandees wringing their hands. Could his populism beat Trump's? California Congressman Ro Khanna is co-chair of the Bernie Sanders campaign, and he's joining me now from Washington. Welcome to the program, Congressman.
Thank you, Christiana. Thank you for having me on.
So, as I said, some are wringing their hands. I guess maybe this isn't the right place to start an interview with the co-chair of the Sanders campaign, but there are very important people in the party who are indeed wringing their hands. What do you say to them on this day after the New Hampshire primary?
They have no reason to worry. They should be happy that Bernie Sanders is winning with rural voters, winning and inspiring minority voters, winning independent voters. He's running on fulfilling FDR's legacy of the New Deal, completing the New Deal in the 21st century. That means everyone should have health care. Everyone should have basic education. Every family should have child care. Every family should have the chance to get a basic job that allows them to have a living wage. These are very common sense ideas that our party has been fighting for 75 years.
I'm going to get to some of the issues in a second, but let me ask you as co-chair, he won, but it was a squeaker. He got 26% of the votes in New Hampshire after getting 25% in Iowa. 26 is the lowest total for anyone who's ever won in New Hampshire. And he's, you know, trailing Pete Buttigieg now by 2 delegates. How do you analyze this picture?
Well, first of all, there were 25 candidates and many formidable candidates. So the fact that he won in that strong a field is extraordinary. And he won across the board. He won with white Americans without college degrees. He won in the Latino community. He won with young voters. He won with voters under 45. He won with rural voters, independent voters. And he's going to be very, very strong heading into Nevada and South Carolina as the electorate becomes more diverse. And he's leading in the big state. So I am very confident that he will be leading in delegates after March 3rd on Super Tuesday, en route to being the nominee.
I think there was quite a lot of surprise at the youth turnout in New Hampshire. He won more voters under 30 than all the other campaigns combined. But the turnout was lower this year than in 2016. It decreased from 19% to 14%. And of course, you know, they are his biggest backers. The young really flock to him. And he promises, yes, you know, for want of a better word, revolution in terms of, you know, turning the system upside down in the ways that you described on health, on education, on all those issues. How do you explain a drop in the youth turnout then in New Hampshire, of all places?
Well, Christiana, I'll be honest. It is a concern. We were hoping for a bigger turnout. That explains some of the drop-off in the polling, which had factored in a 20% young people. But I do think that they're going to turn out when the opposition is Donald Trump. They're not going to turn out necessarily in a multi-candidate primary. But let me acknowledge that we have work to do. We need to collectively, not just Bernie Sanders, but all the candidates in our party, need to make sure young people understand the stakes on climate change, on gun violence, and our voting. And we have to get better at improving that turnout.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders' promises are achievable? And I ask you because, you know, a very eminent economist, Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman, who is, you know, a progressive, I guess, liberal in his own right. I hope I'm describing him correctly in terms of his...
I have tremendous respect for him.
Yes, yes. And he's, you know, he's supported a lot of these things. But he wrote an op-ed, as you know, back at the end of January, saying even if he, Sanders, made it to the White House, he'd have to deal with a Congress and a public considerably less radical than he is and would be obliged to settle for more modest progressive agenda. Do you buy that?
Well, here's my question for Professor Krugman, who I have tremendous respect for as a Nobel laureate economist. Do you think that economists in 1931 would have been able to predict that FDR would get the New Deal and the Social Security Act in 1935? Do you think an economist sitting in 1963 or 1964 would have been able to predict that we would have the Immigration Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act? It always looks impossible until it is done. That's Nelson Mandela. And so my view is the very movement that would carry Bernie Sanders into the presidency and the mandate he would have would fundamentally change our politics tactics fundamentally change what is possible in Congress. And even Nobel laureates can't predict a few years out what is going to be possible in a body politic to accomplish.
So here I am sitting in London, and as you know, in December, there was an election here. And a fairly similar candidate, Jeremy Corbyn, head of the Labour Party, was predicted precisely to have done really well, especially with the young, on the issues that matter to people, you know, health and all the other things that is very similar to what Bernie Sanders says. And as you know, he went down to a crushing defeat. Does that concern you at all?
Well, I think there are very big differences. I mean, Medicare for All, in some sense, is a compromise position. We still are talking about having private health care in this country, private hospitals, private doctors. We're just talking about national health insurance for everyone. Of course, in Britain, there's actual government-provided health care. It's far more left. And then my understanding is there were issues of anti-Semitism that had bubbled up in that election. None of that is present here. Of course, Bernie Sanders has a history of having parents who were suffered because of the Holocaust. He's very proud of his Jewish heritage. He has stood up against anti-Semitism his whole career. And he will have a great vision for peace in the Middle East. So I think the situations are not exactly comparable.
Okay, so now I want to run a soundbite of Bernie Sanders during his victory. And he talked about uniting what is, as you know, a very divided country, also a divided Democratic Party. People are still sort of casting around for electability. And he does have a huge amount of passion that he engenders amongst a lot of people. This is what he said.
What I can tell you with absolute certainty, and I know I speak for every one of the Democratic candidates, is that no matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together. We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
So that's pretty important, what he just said there. I think everybody is, certainly on the Democratic Party, wants to make sure that their party is united, because whatever divides your party pales into comparison as what divides your party from President Trump. So I say all this because, as you know, he called for the same unity after he lost to Hillary Clinton in 2016, but not all his voters, you know, voted for Hillary, and some even voted for Donald Trump. Do you think that would be different this time? Or are they sort of Bernie or bust, the voters?
I do think it will be different. I know to his core, Bernie Sanders believes defeating Donald Trump is the highest priority, and he will work with 110% passion, as will I, as will anyone affiliated with his campaign, to make sure the Democratic nominee wins. I also think many of his supporters recognize the threat that Donald Trump poses to the very institutions of democracy, to the pluralistic sense of America, and will come out. Last time, many people didn't think Donald Trump would win. Finally, there's always a fall off. I mean, there were Hillary Clinton supporters, despite Hillary Clinton's extraordinary effort, who still didn't vote for Obama at the final measure. So I don't think you can look at a fall off in one case and make a conclusion about what will happen with the election against Donald Trump.
You just mentioned abuse of power and the dangers that Democrats identify under this current administration. So I want to ask you a sort of a news of day question because of your role as a congressman. And that is the controversy over the sentencing and the term of Roger Stone, the key aide to President Trump. And he, you know, as you know, when he was sentenced to 7 to 9 years, President Trump, you know, tweeted a lot about how unfair it was for prosecutors to make that. And now the Department of Justice is recommending an unspecified term for him. And many federal prosecutors, I think about 4, have quit. It seems to be in protest. What is your view of this? Because even some, you know, Democrats believe that maybe 7 to 9 years was too long. Nonetheless, what's your view of the intervention of the Justice Department and the Attorney General?
Well, the problem is, again, it raises issues of corruption and nepotism and cronyism. I mean, what makes America unique is our commitment to the rule of law, that we aren't in a country where if you're friends with the president or help the president, that you get a different sense of justice. And here you have an extraordinary intervention by the Justice Department, unprecedented, that they are calling for a reversal of a sentence. I mean, it would be one thing if the prosecutors who actually were in the case were going to the judge, or if the judge were asking for reconsideration. But it should not be a political process. It's symbolic of everything that is wrong with this administration.
And very briefly, we've got 30 seconds. What can Congress do about it?
Well, Congress has oversight over the Justice Department. We fund, ultimately, the Justice Department. They need Congress appropriations. And so we ought to call William Barr in front of Congress. We ought to call the individuals and get the facts and get the documents to understand where the interference was. But the problem is, Christiana, when the Republicans decided not to remove Donald Trump, they sent him a message that he can be as brazen as he wants, and there may not be consequences. And I fear that the only thing really in our country that we can do is now vote him out of office in 2020.
Congressman Ro Khanna, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And turning now to the novel coronavirus, the death toll continues to climb and the infection is disrupting the lives of people all over the world. Just ask the passengers on board the Diamond Princess, the big cruise ship outside Tokyo, where more than 3,000 people are stuck on what's now a giant floating quarantine zone as Japan faces the largest number of cases outside China. Correspondent Matt Rivers got exclusive access to a crew member who gives him a rare and worrisome look on board. Here's that report.
We are doing everything in our power to maximize your comfort during your extended stay with us.
A Wednesday announcement for passengers aboard the Diamond Princess as the captain seeks to reassure them all is okay, saying the air on board is clean. But amidst his crew, there is palpable fear that the virus is spreading. CNN spoke with a crew member aboard the ship, Sonali Tucker. Speaking behind a mask, her message is urgent. Are you concerned that the virus is spreading amongst the crew right now?
Yes, it is, because the number of crew members who are infected is also increasing now.
At least 5 crew members have already tested positive for the virus. Sonali said she's had a fever and chills since Monday. She says her boss told her to stop work and stay in her cabin. She's scared. She's got it, too.
And how does that make you feel?
We just want to get back home safe without this infection. That's all we want.
When we talked, she'd been waiting to see a doctor for 2 days. Meanwhile, about 1,000 of her colleagues kept working because there's over 2,600 passengers on board that have been put in mandatory quarantine by Japan's government, forced to stay in their rooms most of the day. But the ship still needs to run, so the crew works side by side, wearing masks and gloves, though Sonali says mealtime is most dangerous.
So we all remove our masks and gloves when we are eating. So we're all sitting in the same place and having food, and it can spread.
CNN has spoken to multiple infectious disease experts who express skepticism that the current quarantine system is the best way to contain the virus.
I think a lot of thought went into what to do with the passengers, but it puts the crew at increased risk.
Japanese authorities continue to defend their actions, saying they believe anyone who tests positive contracted the virus before the quarantine went into effect. Anyone who tests positive is brought off the ship and sent to local hospitals. Earlier this week, we asked a Japanese health official if the crew was safe.
Is everyone on board the ship being treated the same way? What do you say to their concerns?
We are trying to treat all the people equally. However, we also know that crew members don't have private rooms like the passengers have, and they still have to work and help people on the ship. So it's not all equal. However, we're giving everyone on the ship guidelines for prevention.
Princess Cruises saying it's following Japan's quarantine guidelines, saying the, quote, Japan Ministry of Health has been the lead defining the testing protocols for all guests and crew. But the fact is, as long as Japan continues to insist on quarantining passengers on board the ship, the danger will remain because the crew has to keep working. There's mixed reaction from passengers on board.
The crew are being so good, and I know they're worried as well. I do not feel the quarantine is working. It's a failed quarantine.
During our phone call with Sonali on Wednesday, she had to hang up.
Are you still there?
A doctor had finally come to test her for the virus. She'll find out soon if she tests positive.
How do you feel now that the doctors came to your room?
I'm still scared because I don't want it to be tested.
The Diamond Princess will remain in quarantine until February 19th. Until then, the crew will keep working, more exposed to the virus than the passengers they're taking care of. Matt Rivers, CNN, Yokohama, Japan.
Really frightening, of course. Asian communities have also been hit as fear and prejudice rise. Gilbert Gee is a professor at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, and he says it reminds him of what happened during the SARS crisis and also in the United States during the AIDS crisis. And as the battle against the coronavirus continues, Gee tells our Hari Srinivasan about the hidden cost of epidemics.
So, Professor Gee, we have reports now of hate crimes in the New York City subway system, for example, where an Asian woman wearing a mask was attacked and called diseased. How far back does this history go of using health to discriminate against people?
Yeah, it goes back a couple hundred years. And part of it really has to do with, I think, justifying slavery. You know, it's kind of a difficult proposition to say that we are in a democracy, and at the same time have multiple classes of people that are stratified purely based on their race. And so one way to get out of that intellectual moral conundrum is to say that other races are not equal to us in terms of being human beings. And so we have a long history of using science as a way to justify race differences. There was a pseudoscience called phrenology, where they purported to measure, say, bumps on people's heads, and then from there infer things like intelligence. So we've had a long history of actually medicine and public health and scientific research that's been used to justify that, hey, these racial groups are actually fundamentally different in terms of their physiology. And from that, we've made a lot of mistakes in the research, giving some examples such as the Tuskegee syphilis study, which you may or may not have heard of. But the Tuskegee study was a study of the course, trying to understand the course of syphilis amongst African-Americans in the United States, with the underlying idea that Black bodies reacted to syphilis differently than white bodies. But by the time that study was actually initiated, we already knew that syphilis, we already knew the basic biology and mechanisms of syphilis, but there was still this underlying belief that, well, you know, persons of African descent are fundamentally biologically different, so let's continue with that body of research. So from that understanding of this basis that, or this belief that racial groups are biologically different, that's when we start to have these continuing sort of conflations of, you know, oh, this disease has broken out and it's in, sort of common amongst this population. And so therefore, we need to be careful and watch out about that population. Maybe what the policy response should be would be to deport them or to quarantine them or to not let them into our country or to this particular city. So we definitely have a long history of using science to justify racism. And now we know that most of that science has just been incorrect and totally biased.
You know, the West Coast has a longer history with Asians than the rest of the country does. What were some of the things that happened around the turn of the century, or I should say the turn of the previous century, now that we're in 2020, yeah, but in the late 1800s and the 1900s, where you could see these kind of racially discriminatory policies have a root in public health concerns?
As you mentioned, like, you know, states like California had a fairly large population of, say, Chinese immigrants, and as well as immigrants from other countries. And basically what happened was a lot of these immigrants were used as strikebreakers. And so then what happened is the local workers, you know, American workers were quite unhappy with that and started to lobby, you know, saying that we should exclude these individuals. And that they start to make connections, not only in terms of economic grounds, but using public health as a justification. The idea that Chinese persons were prone to have leprosy, and that, you know, defending against leprosy was actually a good reason to exclude Chinese persons. You know, so using public health, for example, as a rationale to systematically exclude individuals. So that would be like another example.
I mean, your research has pointed out, I mean, going back as far as the Chinese Exclusion Act or the Chinese, yeah, and how they were kind of quarantined in San Francisco while their white neighbors weren't. And we've seen this happen to population, yeah, of Filipinos and Hawaiians. So why is it that this keeps repeating? Right.
You know, we have this belief system that racial groups have these innate attributes, and that's linked to disease. So, you know, there used to be a thought that, for example, that even things like poverty were infectious in some kind, in transmissible in some nature. So if you kind of think that we have this basis of understanding that certain racial groups are certain ways, and that, you know, if these groups have a sort of predisposition to be sick, and then suddenly they are coming in to infect all these other good people that aren't necessarily sick at this moment in time, then you can start to see how race and racism and disease starts to get conflated all together.
Now, look, this is also happening, and in the backdrop is the United States has declared a public health emergency. They're going to deny entry to foreign nationals who've been to mainland China. You know, you've got private companies like Royal Caribbean Cruise Ship recently said that they are not going to allow anyone to board if they have passports from mainland China or Macau or Hong Kong. And then we also literally see countries evacuating their citizens out of specific regions of China. So, I mean, shouldn't people be concerned? I mean, that all creates a climate where we're watching TV and saying, this must be pretty bad if all of these steps, these countries and these companies are taking these steps.
Well, you know, with any outbreak, we should be concerned. This is a novel pathogen that we're encountering. And, you know, we are, as human beings, considered what the epidemiologists call a virgin population. It's a we don't have necessarily an immunity in the population that has encountered this specific coronavirus before, so our bodies are encountering it anew. So we don't necessarily have the defense system within our bodies, both as individual persons and as you know, community members, to kind of protect ourselves, that we might protect ourselves against something like, say, measles and whatnot. But it's also important to keep, you know, what we're understanding in perspective. You know, right now we're still learning about the natural course of this disease and the biology of it. But currently, the best estimate I've seen is right now the fatality rate is something like 3%. And if you put that in perspective of, say, something like SARS, I think the fatality rate for SARS was 10%, and I think MERS was something like 30%. So in sort of that big picture, it's relatively small. I'm not saying people should not be concerned, but, you know, if we start to put it in perspective, another way to think about it is influenza, the common flu, has, I think this year, affected something like 19 million Americans. But we are not exactly panicking in the same way as we are with the coronavirus. And I think part of the reason is that we're so used to the flu and we're so used to having people, you know, be sick to it, that it's no longer a novel threat. So I think part of this reaction to the coronavirus is really part of the novel, is really the novelty of the disease.
You were just saying SARS. What are the things that we learned from that epidemic?
I think we learned a little bit more about coronaviruses in general. And, you know, certainly it's part of the same family, SARS and the novel one that we're encountering today. I think we're also learning a little bit more about being sensitive to communities and really trying not to stigmatize certain communities in relation to that. So, like, I think currently the media response has been a lot better with regards to many media outlets saying, hey, let's not be xenophobic and let's try not to discriminate against certain groups of people. You know, you saw that happen with SARS and a few other outbreaks such as that. I think the general response has been a little better.
You know, I was looking over some of the coverage. We've got papers in Australia who've done front page above the fold headlines, such as China kids stay home. There's a paper in France that had a front page with words yellow alert or yellow fever. I mean, what are the public health consequences when a community is singled out or stigmatized?
So I think there's a several layers to that. So first of all, you know, I think that we understand from a growing body of literature that people who experience discrimination tend to get sicker. And so experiencing discrimination triggers a stress response, and that in turn can lead to other kinds of illnesses that are above and beyond what we're seeing with the coronavirus. It can have sort of long-term effects on things possibly like cellular aging, heart disease, and everything. So there are some long-term effects that might be related to sort of these short-term experiences of discrimination and xenophobia in that sense. I think another piece of it is, you know, we run the risk of allowing for it okay to be discriminatory in our societies. And I think many societies are really trying to move away from that. But diseases somehow allow people to express their xenophobia.
You know, it seems logistically also, if you singled out communities, they might be less willing to come forward when they do have symptoms.
Yeah. And we see that in other cases. So, for example, research on HIV and other things like that, where we find that diseases are stigmatized. A lot of times people become reluctant to seek help because they don't want to be further stigmatized. And it can certainly be a problem where people decide, I'm just going to hold myself underground because people are going to discriminate against me. So that certainly can happen.
What responsibility do you think that the Chinese government plays in how this information has created this environment? Meaning, one of the things that we know in the past is that they have tried to keep a lid on things. And in this particular case, we recently just had the reports that the doctor who was a whistleblower, one of the doctors who was a whistleblower who tried to get the word out about this in December, the local authorities actually chastised him and penalized him for it. And he's just recently died of the virus. So if you're a government, if you're trying to both take care of your people and of your image, what's the best thing that they should have done, could have done?
I think probably a better thing to do would be to first not chastise and do exactly what they did. I think it's, especially in this global world that we live in, my opinion is that more transparency, the better. And the more we can communicate, you know, with scientists and medical practitioners so that we can have a better understanding of, you know, where the diseases are originating, what exactly is happening, how things are being communicated. Because in the world we live in, where we have transportation that takes us literally to all corners of the earth, we also have all these other kind of businesses that require transnational agreements and movement of goods and as well as people and livestock and things like that. And of course, you have animals that don't care about national boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's really important, I think, for scientists and governments to cooperate with each other and be as transparent as possible so we have information and so that we can move rapidly and use accurate information.
So what's a government to do to try to prevent the surface level discrimination and structural discrimination if they have a population that is scared?
Yeah. So I think an important thing is to have consistency in the communications. So in the broader literature on disaster communications, it's really important to have, messages that are coming, say, from the health department and from your physicians and other places such as school principals, all giving somewhat consistent information. Because I think what happens is when the public is getting information from source A and source B and they're conflicting, then people get really confused. And that's when people start to get much more scared and feel like things are not under control. So the more consistency we can have with messaging, with the more these different bodies can communicate with one another and provide accurate information in a timely manner as possible, I think that's one of the better case scenarios.
If you could just compare the responses, you've been studying things like MERS and SARS and, you know, even this coronavirus, compare that, let's say, to HIV or to Ebola, things that had kind of the world on edge?
Well, let's see. I'm not an expert on a lot of those other outbreaks, but I do think that we're in a different moment in time. I do think that the internet and the information environment is quite different than what we had before. We've learned some lessons from the past. You know, we're more careful now to not label diseases and conflate them with people. So, like, using HIV as an example, you know, one of the early names for it was GRID, which was gay-related immune disease, which obviously singled out a specific population. We know that, you know, even though people can discriminate, diseases don't. And so it's something for us to really pay attention to. I think there's definitely a long way to go in terms of, you know, teaching all of us to and always to remind ourselves that, you know, we can't and shouldn't stigmatize individuals and discriminate against them simply because disease originated in a certain place in the world.
Professor Ji, thanks so much for your time. Professor Gilbert Ji from the School of Public Health at UCLA, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
And this is an issue, of course, we are going to be following. And coming up on tomorrow's program, as the closing arguments begin in the rape and sexual assault trial of Harvey Weinstein, I'm joined by an attorney who's representing one of the women testifying against the Hollywood mega producer. Douglas Wigdor takes us inside the courtroom where it's all happening. And finally, government and corporations may be dragging their feet on sustainability, but entrepreneurs and ordinary people are diving into the fray. A new solar-powered robot is saving rhinos in South Africa's Kruger National Park. The 12-feet-tall system, nicknamed Meerkat, has cameras and sensors that can spot and track poachers and alert park rangers. This new technology could be a game-changer as poaching remains a major threat. Over 9,000 have been killed for their horns over the past decade. But thanks to Meerkat, poaching incidents have dropped by 80% in areas where it's been deployed. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.